Hi, Ben.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well here at the Heritage Foundation, Washington, D.C.
Belly of the Beast?
Belly of the Beast, exactly.
How are things in the office there? Are people getting their holiday spirits on?
Yeah, considering it's kind of a rainy, gray day, I would say so. We're here for another edition of This Week in Blog. And I thought I'd open up with a joke this time.
Please.
It's not mine. I stole it from Atarak at the at Atrios at Eschaton, actually. And he writes, "I think this headline is premature. Mets acquire Putz in 3-term deal. At least let him collapse down the stretch in September with the rest of his teammates before you label him." The joke being that J.J. Putz was the closer for the Mariners last year, and the Mets just acquired him in a 3-team deal. Made me laugh, and it made me think that maybe we can get, after the winter meetings are over in Las Vegas, maybe we can get Nate Silver on for another politics-slash-baseball discussion here on This Week in Blog.
You're a budding George Will.
I don't know about that, but I do like a good J.J. Putz joke.
So what's on your mind this week?
Well, I think everyone's mind has to be at least a little bit on the governor of Illinois.
Yes.
And Barack Obama's old Senate seat.
There's a bit of a hubbub around that, I hear.
It's true. It's true. Obviously us on the right are amused, I think would be one way to put it.
Well, I think those on the left are disgusted.
You know, not a lot of untypical reaction on the right. Ross Doubtthat had a post titled "Why Liberals Can't Govern," and he writes, "That's the lesson of the Blagojevich affair, right? And the Rangel case, and the William Jefferson scandal, and many more to come, no doubt. I mean, it seems like a pretty airtight generalization to me. Liberalism's ideological predisposition to expanding government power inevitably leads to gross corruption, which is why we should only trust conservatives, those flinty stewards of the common weal, to run our public institutions." Right, Alan Wolfe? Right. And the joke there being that Alan Wolfe wrote an article for the Washington Monthly with the similar title, "Why Conservatives Can't Govern." So I thought that was a useful riposte by Ross there.
I appreciate Ross's facetiousness. But there's certainly others on the right that are trying to spin out a more anti-liberal, anti-democratic machine narrative out of this.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I think it's one thing that Michelle Malkin also notices, that, you know, so much of the coverage immediately is like, oh, my God, this is going to be a great boom for conservatives. Conservatives are gleeful with this. So, Michelle Malkin noticed that Reuters ran a story that said conservatives gleeful over governor's arrest. And Michelle writes, "The piece mentions Blago reaction from the RNC, Washington Times, Rush Limbaugh, Neil Boritz, and yours truly. Maybe I miss it, but I don't remember seeing finger-wagging Reuters article headlines, 'U.S. liberals gleeful, Abramoff delay, Stephen Foley, etc., etc.' Do you?" And I don't. I thought that was a good point, that on all the cable shows, well, not Fox News, but MSNBC, the rest of them, and Reuters, there was a story of, oh, you know, this is, conservatives are going to be so happy about this. And it's true, we're happy, but, you know, when all the Republican Abramoffs of the world were going down in flames, you didn't see those, oh, liberals are going to be so happy about this stories.
Well, I would think the difference there is it's only very recently that a lot of traditional media even cared about what liberals had to say. We weren't really seen as being very influential in the broader national discussion. Now, I think that's changing, post-election. You're now seeing more pieces like New York Times today doing a whole piece on the American Constitution Society, for example, as the liberal legal community that modeled itself after the conservative Federalist Society. There never was a profile about the American Constitutional Society before this, whereas there have been reams of things said about the Federalist Society. So I would just say to Michelle, you know, wait a couple years, and soon you'll see more Wire stories about overgeneralizing what liberals have to say.
We'll see. We may even see that today when we get to our second topic. But were there any other posts on the left you wanted to bring up with
Joyage? I think folks who are interested in following the story closely, I would recommend Marcy Wheeler at Empty Wheel, emptywheel.firedoglake.com. You know, she really bared her nose in Plamegate and following Patrick Fitzgerald, so she has a good sense of how Fitzgerald operates. A couple things of note in pushing back in some of the conservative narratives. She noted that Blagojevich SIU content is not Andy Stern. There was some earlier speculation around that. I guess all those nutters trying to take down Obama and Stern are going to have to work hard to make a mountain out of a molehill. And she also had a post today about talk of Jesse Jackson Jr. being Senate candidate number 5. And she's speculating, well, do we have, you know, they met this past Monday. So the open question is, was that meeting taped or not? And she, I think, generally seems to think that it probably was, and said that, if Fitzgerald told Jackson that he's not accused of any misconduct after hearing tapes of Monday's meeting, that carries more weight than if he only knew what Blago had been saying on earlier tapes. Presumably, if they said something that was outright criminal, you know, Jesse would be arrested along with Blago, and that did not happen. Now, she doesn't say that's the definitive scenario, but just one of many. And Arch Pundit, who is a longtime Illinois blogger, I think also is a good person to check out throughout all this. Going back to the SIU business, he notes that it looks like it was an Illinois SEIU person who had that meeting with the governor's staff. Person's name was Balanoff. And my guess is that Balanoff may well have been said he'd run up the ladder and lied about that whole part of running up the ladder, that the SEIU saw the governor as a problem more than an ally in recent months isn't a big secret. There's a couple of thoughts on the left that I thought, a couple of folks on the left who are doing some good blogging on the subject worth checking out.
Well, let me ask you this, because before Hot Rod basically took over this week and crushed the Obama message of the week, we were talking about Obama meeting with the governors and mayors and getting their wish list for stimulus packages. And, you know, last week we talked a lot about stimulus and how effective it might be, et cetera. You know, does it give you pause at all to think that the Rod Blagojevich of the world and the other governors are going to be the ones that decide which projects are going to be worthy or not for getting this economy back on track?
Well, you certainly want this to be done as apolitically as possible. And if you got folks, you know, like Blagojevich, who are, forgive me, I'm going to butcher his name repeatedly in this dialogue. You don't want folks like that, you know.
So how do you get the governors of states out of the process?
Well, let's not presume that all other 49 governors are as corrupt as him. I'm not terribly concerned about that, but you certainly don't want to have the entire process be solely dictated. You know, through those means, you want gubernatorial input, and Obama's talked about that. You want mayoral input, but you also want to have some part of the process that's sort of out of, you know, that's why you talk about an infrastructure bank. So you'd have an independent entity review these projects on the merits outside of the more traditional political avenues. And I'm quite sure.
But the whole point of the stimulus is to get it out quickly, and
yeah,
it's going to take forever to set up a independent infrastructure bank. I mean, it took years to set up the you know, military base closing commission.
Well, you have the governors have said to Obama, and I know what Heritage feels about this. They feel they got, you know, X number of projects that are shovel ready.
Shovel ready. I love that term.
I know you do. And there's probably a certain amount of again, I don't know exactly how this process is going to work, but presumably there'll be a certain amount of deference given to the governors on that front. Because these are projects that have gone through a lot of the bureaucratic process already. They've gone through a lot of hurdles. The large majority of them probably are going to be solid, and you can be more comfortable putting money into those things to get that quick boost into the economy. But you know, the broader package, and you know, my group, Campaign for America's Future, are our think tank wing, Institute for America's Future, put out a $900 billion two-year Main Street recovery program this week that was backed by over 200 economists and labor leaders and such. You know, the buzzwords here are substantial, strategic, and sustained. It's not a one-off temporary stimulus. It's a more long-range public investment strategy. So to have some things that, you know, governors and mayors are saying, hey, this stuff's already gone through the hurdles.
Have you taken a look at that list that the U.S. Conference of Mayors put out on
their wish list? I saw what you guys put up there from Istook, who has a great record, I believe, when he was in Congress, and very mocking of things like bike paths, when bike paths are, in fact, a very critical part of infrastructure that are not luxury recreational items, but pretty critical as far as giving people transit options that are not, you know, fossil fuel based, that are actually not only good for our energy security, but also good for people's health. More people would do bike commuting, for example, if they had easily accessible, well-maintained bike paths, and they're actually not terribly expensive.
And of course, we know that Howard Dean got his start in politics because over a bike path proposed near his church.
He did, and conservatives like to mock him for it.
Yes.
But it actually was a very sensible project to get involved in.
Not all bike paths are created equally, but you're forgetting there are the rest of two-thirds of the projects on that list that ISTA put together, which were museums and parking garages. I'm surprised someone as green as you would be for creating more free parking on the taxpayers' dime.
Well, in all these cases, you know, you could have a good bike path or a bad bike path. You could have a parking garage that makes sense, or you could have a parking garage that is putting too much emphasis on cars, not enough on bike paths.
So you could have
a museum that's going to be very good for downtown tourism. You could have a museum that's a boondoggle. So just saying the buzzwords, and this is sort of John McCain's, you know, broad brush. Let's make fun of bear DNA studies when, in fact, the bear DNA study made a lot of sense. That's not the way to decide whether these projects have merit or not.
And so does your guy's $900 billion plan that you put forward, does that pick the good museums from the bad?
I don't believe we had any museums in our project, actually.
Too bad. You missed out. Apparently, museums are important draws for downtown tourism, you just said.
Well, you know, in my area here, neighboring town of Amherst, this is probably something you guys would mock. They actually got federal, state, and I think they had federal, state, city funding for a nonprofit movie theater. But that was actually a pretty important thing to have, because having a downtown with no movie theater means you're not going to have any kind of, you know, commerce at night. It's much harder to be able to come downtown to a restaurant if they can't do a dinner and a movie at the same time. So actually having a nonprofit movie theater made a lot of sense.
So, people are able to put together studies showing that, you know, all the ballparks that have been approved.
A lot of the ballparks are boondoggles. I fully agree with that. I mean, it's...
Right. So I guess I'm saying, you know, where is all this academic fine-tuned... objective analysis to show the boondoggle ballparks from the cost-effective non-for-profit theaters and museums at night?
Well, I think that's what the infrastructure bank concept is supposed to do. And
how on earth would they possibly know and gather and get all this information correct?
I'm not an urban planner, so I'm not gonna, I can't speak into how the details of these things work are concerned. Only thing I'd suggest to you is, I know you and Heritage don't like this entire concept of having public investment in American infrastructure. So it's harder to take the specific criticisms as seriously. If you come into this from the perspective of, we'd like to make this work as well as possible, so here are some ideas of good infrastructure investments, here's some examples of bad ones, that would be a more credible way to approach the discussion. But Heritage seems to be looking to take blanket pot shots as opposed to actually looking at these things on the merits.
It's true. We take a very philosophical and principled understanding that, you know, there's no way a room full of experts is going to be able to gather all the appropriate data to tell all the good museums from the bad and all the good ballparks from the bad parking garages and all the rest of it.
I'm sure there are many professional urban planners that would greatly disagree with you.
Oh, and I'm sure they are, and I'm sure they're all liberal Democrats. you know, It's just that the Hayekian conservative libertarians would just strongly disagree with those people about how much central planning can really accomplish. But I wanted to bring up one other Chris Bowers post.
Sure.
At Open Left. It was called Pay to Play and Vote to Play. He says, at the center of the Radha Bagoyajit scandal is an allegation that he was putting the U.S. Senate seat up for sale. This is pretty bad, and Blagojevich needs to step down and face trial. Still, it needs to be remembered that the only reason Blagojevich seems to be in trouble is because he was selling the seat for money. If he was selling the seat for votes, personal power, or a committee chairmanship, he would probably have been fine. After all, over the past month, there have been at least two high-profile instances of conservative Democrats selling their membership in their party for committee chairmanships. First, Lieberman managed to acquire a Senate chairmanship by threatening to vote with another party. Beyond Lieberman, three Democratic members of the New York State Senate are currently doing the same thing. While it's not illegal to threaten to switch voting habits if certain demands are not met, it is just as unprincipled as selling a Senate seat for money. In both cases, power is for sale, for its own sake, prior beliefs and values be damned. I'm not saying these sorts of threats should become illegal. Instead, I am arguing that these threats from conservative Democrats to flip parties are entirely unprincipled to the same degree as Blagojevich. So if you refuse to sell and the person making the threats follows through, in the end you will look better and the person making the threats will be out of a job before too long. So, you know, Chris is objecting to not just, you know, selling votes for money, bribes, but for other things like chairmanships, seats on boards, etc. But, you know, that's a lot of what goes into politics. And, you know, you seem to put all your faith in this, you know, room full of experts that are going to objectively manage and pick $1 trillion worth of infrastructure spending around the nation. And the reality is that's just not how this is going to go down. And I'm just baffled that someone can actually think that way. Politics, when you run $1 trillion through Washington, politics and the trading of votes and projects for chairmanships and horse trading on other issues, etc., inevitably happens. That's what government is. I guess I'm just, you know, baffled at both Chris's and yours faith that somehow this, you know, $1 trillion worth of spending is going to be go through Washington and be able to filter through the right experts and make sure everything's spent efficiently.
Well, that is very much in line with the very famous Heritage Foundation white paper, Taking Charge of Federal Personnel, which is very dismissive of, in their words, the progressive view of government that bases a lot of government actions on merit and policy expertise and puts the primacy on politics and loyalty to get ideological objectives achieved. I don't disagree with you that it's probably impossible to remove all politics out of politics. And some politics is always a good thing. You want politicians that are responsive to their constituents and not based everything on very cold, dispassionate cost-benefit analyses. Some things, you know, require a human touch. But you want to mitigate. You know, but anything can be excessive, and as much as we can mitigate the bad parts of politics, the pork barrel part of politics, and combine that with more meritocratic basis for policymaking, the better we're going to be. Obama is committing, as part of his platform for governance, more of that, and we'll see it work, and we can come back in 2 years or 4 years and see how successful he was.
Well, speaking of transparency, another issue cropped up with the Blagojevich scandal. And that was Obama's Open for Questions site or page on his transition website. Mark Ambiter reports that, you know, as early as 1995, Obama has maintained that this would be a legitimate model of healthy government. Open for Questions will probably be a vehicle for the Obama grassroots groups to organize support around the White House priorities. It'll help him get political cover for more controversial items that he wants to tackle, and it's a side bend of making sure the White House never loses touch with priorities or the electorate. Could this backfire in the White House? Of course. Obama seems to trust voters enough right now to take that risk. But, of course, then we have Ben Smith reporting today that any Blagojevich questions on the Open for Question any Blagojevich-related questions on the Open for Question sites are basically being flagged and censored right out of the site. So Ed Morrissey at Hot Air writes, on a campaign website, a candidate and staff would immediately rid themselves of anything embarrassing so that the candidate didn't have to answer for it. Obama stopped being a candidate on November 4th and became the president-elect. We know this because Obama has a government website and a big sign that says Office of the President-elect. In other words, it's time for accountability. If Obama doesn't want to answer tough questions, he should stop trolling for them on official government websites. And since we're all paying for it, nobody should be able to force those questions off an official government website. So, you know, already we're seeing cracks in the transparency foundation of Barack Obama.
Well, it's not terribly opaque if everybody sees this happening. John Cole at Balloon Juice, ripped Ben Smith's blog post on this and said, quote, Obama supporters are not censoring their voting. Jesus the stupid. He doesn't really understand or care about the spirit of the effort here to get questions about issues that concern people. And that's referencing to the fact, I mean, the whole concept here is that these questions get put up on the site, and then the users vote on which questions are important to them. And as John Cole noted, there was
effort. But it's going to be a bunch of, some people have derisively called them, Obamatards on that site. You're going to have a pack mentality that it's just going to be an Obama, Obama's awesome echo chamber.
That's not censoring.
And there's going to be zero transparency. The goal is transparency. The goal is fostering conversation.
I mean,
if you have a tool that empowers a pack of people to silence other people's questions that are dissent-related, you're not going to have any transparency. You're not going to have any openness.
Well, I'm not going to argue that the system as it stands right now is necessarily going to achieve the results everybody wants.
Well, if you're punching on transparency
It's a first attempt at trying to have a more transparent government through online tools, and we can look at it and say, here's what worked and here's what didn't. But because there was an organized effort on the right to say that there's only Obama bots that were knocking us down, there was a right effort to push up these questions. And there was a counter effort.
When he's president, that's what we want, right?
What's that?
When he's president, that's what we want. We want people who have dissenting opinions to have their questions be answered and addressed by the Obama by the Obama administration instead of silenced by a bunch of Obama bots.
The whole concept is people vote. Okay, the whole structure is people vote. If more people vote for certain questions about policy and vote down questions about penny ante scandals. That could very well be the system working, not necessarily censoring. Censorship is silencing citizens.
You keep saying vote as if this is some type of ballot box that everyone in the nation participates in, but this is an arena where you're going to have a preponderance of people that love Obama, and we already know that Obama fans have a lot bigger presence than Obama skeptics. So
that may be an argument for this structure for a government website isn't conducive to getting a full range of questions up there. That may well be true. But it's not censorship. It has nothing to do with censorship. It's a question of how do you achieve the best amount of transparency. And the mere fact that you know that these questions have been voted down by people is an aspect of transparency. It's not being done behind the scenes. It's not being done by government officials deleting things from a website. It's being done openly through this voting process. It's not censorship.
Yeah, I don't think censorship's the right word, but to say that it advances transparency is, I believe pretty much false rhetoric. I mean,
it may be a transparency idea, but it's not the exact opposite of transparency because you know what has happened so far.
As long as the Ben Smiths of the world keep reporting on what's being taken out of it. But I think this is a good transition to the next, since we're talking about dissent, which is I would say somewhat manufactured left versus Obama stories that we saw cropping up at the end of last week and beginning of this week. Do you want to go ahead and cite some of your more favorite posts on the matter?
Well, this all started. I mean, there's already a bit of percolating liberals not being happy with certain Obama cabinet picks that he was making. We talked about that in our last Blocking Heads.
Right.
My point there was, there's actually a range of opinion on the left about this stuff. It's not a monolithic blast of criticism. So you had Steve Hildebrand, who was one of Obama's campaign aides, put up a post on Huffington Post critical of the left wing of the Democratic Party for being critical of Obama's cabinet picks and trying to put the emphasis more on policy and trying to reassure people that on the policy objectives, they are very much on a progressive track. But the tone and some of the wording in the piece definitely raised the ire of some people, particularly David Sirota. And he wrote on our Campaign for America Futures blog as well as elsewhere, most progressives questioning Obama have done so rather gently and have done so in the pragmatic substance. For instance, people wondering about the appointment of Larry Summers to a top economic position in the White House have wondered whether it's such a good idea to empower an ideological free market fundamentalist whose policies as Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary played a major role in creating the economic crisis. Some think standing for progressives concerned about the Iraq War, they wonder whether the ideologues who got us into the war are really the most qualified people to get us out. They believe that perhaps the pragmatists who opposed the war on the basis of factual analysis of intelligence might be better suited to the task. Are such questions really the inappropriate queries of a bunch of radical revolutionaries from the left? Tim Fernholz at Tapped felt he read a totally different article. He says, sort of takes the most issue with the paragraph where Hildebrand seems to draw a distinction between liberal priorities and other pressing issues, writing, but first let's get our economy moving, bring our troops home safely, fix health care and climate change, and restore our place in the world. It's somewhat unfortunate construction, but I read this as an attempt to move the centered leftwards. If those four goals, including climate change and health care reform, are identified as centrists, then progressives are free to advocate for the more sensible proposals that are even further out of the supposed mainstream, prison reform, the labor agenda, and the Defense Against Marriage Act. You get my point. You also had this ended up blowing into an entire New York Times story, which actually covered the range of opinions that are out there. My boss, Bob Borsage, was quoted in that saying, you know, hey, if supposed centrists are going to be executing a progressive agenda, you know, we'll take that.
I thought Atrios had a great post along those lines. The irrational angry left, he called it. Atrios writes, the Obama campaign didn't exist to make me feel good, and the Obama presidency won't either. I don't especially like his people punching the dirty effing hippies under the bed. But on the other hand, if they manage to convince people that Obama is a sensible centrist who wants to do sensible centrist things like build super trains, get out of Iraq, not torture people, or invade random countries, strengthen labor protections, reduce income inequality, improve education, provide health care for people, and reduce poverty, well, those damn dirty hippies just won't shut up about their magic ponies. It's fine by me. For years, we've had Democrats railing against those crazy hippies as an excuse not to do all those things. If Obama's people are going to rail against those hippies and use it as an excuse to do them, fine with me. If. Period.
One wonders if we're being triangulated against at the same time moving the center leftwards as part of a grand strategy, but who knows if it's all that well thought out or not.
Well, no, but like, if you were in, and I know you hate conspiracy theories, and I kind of do too, but if you were in the Obama White House transition team, isn't that exactly what you would want to do?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of, you know, Sirota's criticism is that it's not healthy long-term to be continually trivializing and marginalizing, you know, people in your base. You want to develop a more constructive relationship with them. And I think you can take that criticism and also...
But maybe Obama thinks his base is larger than what you consider to be the left.
Well, these aren't necessarily objectives at odds. You know, the notion of defining as the center these long-standing liberal progressive goals is obviously a very healthy thing for the left. But can you do that without having to take a gratuitous shot at individual people for, as even I think, you know, folks like Ben Smith and Mark Amter have said, pretty mild criticism. The people weren't really throwing temper tantrums on the left here.
It has. I mean, Bowers had another post. I know I'm picking on Bowers, but I am a big Bowers fan. So, you know, too bad. He had a good post called Simple Dramas Packaged for Consumption. And, you know, he details who's picked him up, who hasn't picked him up, and why. And he then concludes, I don't know why so many news organizations are struggling to pay their bills these days, but I can't imagine that using people to fit into simplistic, pre-established narrative about something that is actually complex and very important is helping that much. Granted, my little media outlet is far smaller and generates less far revenue than most, so perhaps I don't have the secret to media profitability. However, I think news consumers are better informed and smarter than they often are given credit for being by news producers. This belief comes from having to deal directly with many of the people who consume my website on a daily basis. And I guess I just disagree with Chris there. I do think that the media producers of the world do have a lower opinion of what will captivate people's attention. The Obama versus the angry left storyline was just too easy to write. it's just too easy of as Chris said, a prepackaged storyline, prepackaged simple drama, not to write up. So you know, I think, you know, taking the more atrios view of we'll play the bad guy as long as it helps move the party to the goal line, I'm fine with that.
Now, next phase of this ongoing discussion, I think, is Obama's reported picks for most of his environmental positions. There was a report yesterday that he has settled on EPA, Energy, Council for Environmental Quality, and a new energy czar position that they don't want to call czar, but sort of a new position.
Oh, now we're calling everybody czar these days.
Well, and I think the Obama people seem kind of tired by that.
I'm for it.
So I don't know what they're going to call the position, but something that would coordinate, you know, broader energy, global warming issues across these agencies. And the reaction from pretty much most bloggers on the left had been very positive, particularly about Stephen Chu, who is a Nobel Award-winning atomic physicist. It tickles everyone's, you know, science spot. So Brad Johnson at the Wonk Room, President-elect Barack Obama's reported selection of Dr. Stephen Chu as Secretary of Energy is a bold stroke to set the nation on the path to a clean energy economy. Chu, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, is the sixth director of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, a Department of Energy-funded basic science research institution managed by the University of California. All of this socialism, nonstop. After moving to Berkeley's lab from Stanford University in 2004, Chu, quote, has urged internationally to champion science as society's best defense against climate catastrophe. As director, Chu has steered the direction of Berkeley's lab to addressing the climate crisis, pushing for breakthrough research in energy efficiency, solar energy, and biofuels technology. Over at Climate Progress, Joe Rahm says he sort of gets both climate and energy efficiency.
I honestly don't know. What's Chu's past on nuclear power? I mean, especially considering he comes from Lawrence Livermore.
I don't know off the top of my head. He may have one. I know he's an atomic physicist, but I don't know specifically what his
well, atomic physicists would tend to suggest that he probably knows something about nuclear power.
Hey, what?
One would hope. So yeah, I think it'll be. I mean, that's. I was very interested in the pick. I was a little busy. Didn't have time to look up his nuclear energy bona fides.
You know, he now has to manage the entire nuclear supply of our country. So.
Right.
One hopes he knows something.
So
I'd also add that the seminal Josh Nelson had a very good roundup of other blog reaction out there under the title "Adults Put Back in Charge at DOE."
Yeah. So we'll see if Chu stays on everyone good side, and how nuclear plays into all that.
I'm fascinated by the right's fascination with nuclear, because, you know, there's debate on the left about nuclear.
There is. Not a lot. I mean, it's pretty one-sided.
Well, yeah, I've seen Gore get mocked as being someone who's sort of fervently anti-nuclear, and he actually isn't. He's only said that it's not the best bang for your buck as far as generating energy and reducing carbon emissions, but he's not out there. He's talking about civil disobedience to stop coal-fired plants, not nuclear plants.
Right, but it's never on his list of possible solutions. It's not a priority. And he makes it very clear that you're not supposed to call it clean energy. It's not like he doesn't treat it like coal. It's not like, you know, it's like the devil's, you know, food or something. But right. You know, it's something he always leaves off the holy list of clean energies.
Well, I mean, but he has an argument why that is. It's not coming from a knee-jerk place. He's made an argument that this is not actually financially, each individual plant is so expensive to put up that it's not going to be the best use of your resources. Because he has an overarching goal about trying to stop global warming. What I don't understand is what is the right's underlying principle here. There seems to be an obsession about nuclear, from my perspective, because it annoys liberals, as opposed to actually being part of a well-thought-out energy policy.
Well, I would say, you know, I wouldn't take John McCain's "we need to build 75 nuclear power plants by, I don't know, whatever year it was, as the lodestar of the right's position on nuclear power. I can tell you Heritage's position, which I agree with, which is that we need to, you know, completely revamp the regulatory structure of the nuclear industry. You know, France, you're actually able to have, you know, nuclear fuel reprocessing, which is just not allowed here. So there are some things that we can do to make nuclear more cost effective that don't involve subsidies. It just involves you know, rewriting a regulatory framework.
I don't think France's nuclear industry is wholly a free market enterprise.
No, I didn't say it was, but you know, they don't ban nuclear reprocessing like we do.
Although reprocessing is not a 100% squeaky clean thing. It still leaves behind waste that people have not solved what to do with yet.
That's true. I'm just saying that I do hold hope that that Chu, as a atomic physicist, will bring a non-jaundiced view towards what nuclear can accomplish.
We will see.
We will see.
We could probably wrap it up there if you wanted to. Or do you want to do auto bailout?
Oh, you didn't want to talk about the RNC chairman's race anymore?
Oh, that too. I'm sorry. I told you, all this talk about division on the left, I missed my opportunity for division on the right.
Oh, well, I don't know if RNC chairman's race really is the place to talk about division on the right. We can talk about two things. We can talk about the RNC chairman's race, and then I would say a Bill Kristol article this past week generated more actual division on the right. But yeah, there's a race for the RNC chairman position. And I mean, are you interested in it much? Because you wanted to talk about it, but I got to say it kind of bores me.
I haven't been following it that closely. And when I saw that Mike Duncan threw his hat in the ring, the current RNC chair,
right,
on an argument, look how awesome we've done in the past few weeks. We kept a Georgia Senate seat and we beat one of the most pathetically corrupted Democratic congresspeople in New Orleans. Look what a good job I'm doing. Keep me around. My interest got a little piqued again at what the underlying fault lines were. And actually, I was hoping you would tell me.
Okay.
Where are the different camps here, and what's driving the discussion?
Well, I don't have a lot of insight into it. I do have a good Mark Ambiter post on it, and everything he wrote sounded right to me. And of course, there is more of a next right tech angle to it, as far as what the online right is pushing. But back to Ambiter, he breaks down the field this way. There are five candidates actively courting support at this moment: RNC Chairman Mike Duncan, South Carolina Party Chairman Kayton Dawson, Michigan Chair Sal Anazuzis, Michael Steele, and ex-Huckabee campaign manager Chip Saltzman. He then breaks down the field this way. Anazuzis is the only candidate who represents a state north of the Mason-Dixon line. He talks like a regular guy, knows how to frame economic issues, but he has no real record of success in Michigan, and some RNC members believe he is a stalking horse for Mitt Romney. On Dawson, he's been a very successful chairman of the South Carolina Republican Party, but then again, it's hard not to be a successful GOP chair of the South Carolina Party. That said, a large tranche of the party, including well-respected governors like Carrie Barber, want the next chairman to come from someplace other than the South. But that's also true. Steele is the semi-celebrity candidate owing to his Fox News contributorship. Steele's the best communicator of the bunch, although Dawson, Duncan, and Azuzis have all have been given informal Fox News tryouts. So that's the race. No one in particular stands out for me. I've seen Steele say way too many kind of more centrist big government things, so he's not my favorite.
But he was leading in that next right user poll.
That's true.
Do you know why that is?
There is lots of speculation that that's driven by Steele people.
Hmm.
So,
And I saw that Catherine Lopez at the corner thought that Karl Rove's column today was an implicit swipe at Steele for not running GOPAC well.
I agree. There's, you know, it pains me to agree with Karl Rove. But yeah, there is a lot of feeling that I'm familiar with that Steele not the right guy for the job on message or competency in rebuilding the party right now. But that's just my opinion.
So there's no conservative hero that everyone's coalescing around.
There's no Howard Dean, no.
And what do people think about Duncan sticking around?
I haven't heard anyone that's been chanting 4 more years, if that's your question.
All right then.
But there is this we talked about 2 weeks ago, this rebuildtheparty.com site that Patrick Ruffini and a bunch of other guys have put up, and a lot of the candidates have commented on it supportingly. Chip Saltzman had a post, not directly about it, but he mentioned it. And the title was Rebuilding Online, and in that post, Saltzman writes, "I recommend that we reorganize the party structure by integrating e-campaign staff into every department. In fact, the committee should consider making the e-campaign director deputy chief of staff." Michael Turk, who worked at the RNC and for Bush, then wrote a post at the Next Right, disagreeing with Saltzman's recommendations. He writes, "The first part of that, inserting an e-campaign specialist in each department, is something I believed in through the Bush-Cheney 04 campaign and my tenure at the RNC. I discovered, however, that it actually doesn't work. While it sounds great on paper, it ends up creating a half dozen or so more marginalized positions on the staff. Why? The simple answer is the division heads. The next chair should rethink the fundamental structure of the RNC and the job functions of each department. For instance, communications is typically responsible for both press and mass market appeals. Anyone who has worked in both roles knows that you don't talk to people via your website the same way you talk to reporters. Why not rethink the way we communicate to bring in more line with what is proven to work in corporate America? Rarely do investor relations, media relations, and marketing rest in the same office. Typically, sales and marketing share a common business line, as do media and investor communications. I wouldn't have an e-campaign director. I think the very idea of the job serves only to perpetuate the idea of the online campaign as somehow separate and distinct from the rest of the RNC. As the former e-campaign director, I can say without reservation that the position simply creates a distinction that shouldn't exist. You need someone who understands technology, databases, web application development, list growth, etc., but that person is secondary to having someone who can drive the organization toward a philosophy that embraces these tactics." And that's something I overall agree with. I think it minimizes it to have, we need an online person. And instead, you need someone who understands that the online component is integral and inseparable from the rest of the communications.
And that person is?
Not me. I already told you I didn't have a favorite in this race.
But I wasn't sure if they're arguing that there was one candidate that is particularly considered to be the online savvy candidate.
No, he didn't. He did recommend a friend of mine, John Hinckley, to head up the communication shop, but you know, to be a staff member at the RNC, but not as head. No one is really, you know, the online right is not coalescing around anyone behind the to be the RNC chair.
Shouldn't there be some? I saw the reference to corporate America. Shouldn't there be some CEO who has done such a super awesome job at online communications without all that stinky government bureaucracy that you could tap to do this sort of thing?
Well, you know, we've had trouble with candidate recruitment. Maybe there's no one who wants the job. I don't know.
We'll see.
Speaking
of fantastic corporate communications, the auto bailout.
Ah, auto bailout.
Those corporations, those three guys know how to communicate.
They're not winning.
I'm just a side point. Forgive me if I digress here.
But sure.
Going back to the whole infrastructure discussion. There's good projects and bad projects. There's good bike paths and bad bike paths. And your argument is always that government's not equipped to make these calls. But there are good corporate projects and bad corporate projects. There are good business decisions made and bad decisions made.
It's true.
And there are certain things that procedurally private sector is more agile at, and there are certain things that only government can step in and do, like high-speed rail or smart electric goods, for example. In the case of the automakers, if I can segue back, these three guys, GM, Ford, and Chrysler, spent the last two decades resisting government regulation, saying, "We don't tell us what to do. Don't tell us we need fuel-efficient cars. We know what we're doing." And we've seen these guys, you know, make mistake after mistake after mistake, and their communication capabilities. These aren't the guys that the Republican Party should turn to for advice on how to communicate.
I don't think anyone is turning to Detroit for advice on how to run things.
Right. So here we are trying to figure out how to not have the economy, you know, go deeper into the abyss. And we've already lost nearly 2 million jobs this year already, and one of the reasons why I think Congress is in such a bind is, you know, the automakers have done such a poor job communicating their argument that there's not strong public support for it. I've seen different polling on it. There's one point that was dead split and one that was leaning against. But I think everyone some people are terrified that letting these guys go down would do such damage to the economy. Mark Zandi, at the testimony last week, said it would be cataclysmic, and that's not a guy who's part and parcel of the auto industry by any stretch. So you start to see in the liberal blogosphere more talk about this. D-Day pointing a finger at potential obstructionists in the Senate. Quote, the neo-Hooverists, that term is being used a lot more now in the liberal blogosphere. The neo-Hooverists are who are putting us on the road to a completely deindustrialized and unsustainable America. Seeing the Forest said Republicans say the cure is for companies to stop providing good benefits, and the way to get there is to break the unions. That's their beef for this auto loan discussion. They want to break unions across the board and stop companies from providing any benefits. Kevin Drum had a slightly different take on it. Obviously, I have mixed feelings about all of this. No one wants to see hundreds of thousands of auto workers collecting unemployment, especially now. But at the same time, it doesn't make much sense to keep GM and Chrysler alive as zombie companies for the next couple of years. And the idea of a car czar doesn't appeal much either. It's only systemic restructuring that's going to make a difference here. And the deal we've struck so far doesn't really seem to accomplish that. I think that's true. I think what we have right now is essentially a Band-Aid to get them through to January, March, so once Obama gets in and Democrats have more people in the Senate, they could do something that was more comprehensive and had more actual restructuring involved. And this is the best they can do.
What kind of restructuring are you envisioning here? Because, you know, I hear you say, oh, you know, if only the automakers had embraced regulation and made fuel-efficient cars, they'd all be solvent now. So I guess you firmly believe that Congress can run auto companies effectively. And that they can turn this around. I mean, is that the restructuring that you think is going to save Detroit?
My landline phone battery is clicking low on me, so if I cut off, that's why.
Okay.
It's not because I can't answer your question. Dan Neal, I might have mentioned this before, Dan Neal, who's the LA Times auto columnist, he had a piece that said nationalize GM temporarily. When he was asked about this on Harbaugh afterwards, he said, I'm not arguing that the government knows how to run the company. You would hire the people to actually do that. But there's things that we want the car companies to do for the national good, more fuel-efficient cars, for example, that they're not going to do on their own, and they need to have a hammer over their head to do it. And he cited the example of Conrail, the freight rail company that was temporarily nationalized but then built back up and resold at a profit. Under Reagan, as an example, that government can do these things even if they don't have the literal direct expertise to run it actually themselves. So that's why I think no one's really talking about an actual nationalization except for Dan Neal, but that it's in that vein, I think, of what's being talked about when you talk about Karzai, for example.
Yeah, I would just close on two things that unfortunately blogging heads listeners have already seen or heard, and that is, you know, basically as Megan has pointed out, you know, it just wasn't economically possible for the automakers of Detroit to make the lower margin fuel efficient cars and stay profitable. And secondly, you know, the auto bailout is inevitable. It might not happen by January 2nd, but
GM might not make it to January 2nd.
We'll see. You know,
Pelosi said that they may go to the TARP if this gets filibustered.
We'll see if they do, if it does get shot down in the Senate, which I thoroughly hope it does. You know, I just don't see GM not being able to sell off something in order to stay afloat. But it's really kind of an academic question because you know, come January 20th. The left is going to nationalize the auto industry.
I don't think it's going to be a flat-out nationalization, but there'll be more government involvement for sure.
Oh, which you seem to think there's some possible line between a little bit more government involvement, just enough to make them profitable again and save jobs, is going to be somehow different than nationalization, and there's not. You guys are going to own a car company, three of them. Enjoy it, love it.
Your money too. Your tax money.
My tax money.
We'll own it together.
My tax money, but your movement and your party. So, you know, like I said last week, enjoy running GM.
Well, I don't even want to enjoy it. It's cleaning up a mess from the past that needs to be done. That's what governing's all about.
So we'll leave this week the same place we left last week.
Okay. Have a good weekend.
You too.